This morning you talked a little bit about a team,
mm-hmm.
and team evangelists.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just explain a little bit how you recruit a team and what do you do?
Okay. The team we operated with was just one other couple, Ken Lotus and his wife, and us. And Ken came down, Ken and Carol, they came down about a year and a half after we did, and we were just kind of getting started. But Ken and I were buddies from college days, and I kind of knew what he had going for him, and he kind of knew what I had going for me. And we figured between the two of us, we'd make one good man. And that's kind of the idea, see, because, you know, I'm the kind of guy that will come up with a lot of ideas. And Ken has the ability to tell me which ones stink. And so if I could get an idea past Ken, I knew it would be a good one. And so we really work together well that way. And I'm the kind of a guy who will make things happen. And then Ken's the kind of guy who'll straighten them out after they happen. And so, you know, I'll put the frame up of the house, and then Ken'll do the cabinet work. And so, you know, just guys with, you know, people with different interests, different gifts, just make you complete. I think if it's just one person, often what happens is that the ministry that you develop will show all the strengths and weaknesses that you have. You see? And so, yeah, I would say, you know, try to pick people who you have an affinity with, who have some differences as far as gifts are concerned. Now, often there's tension on a team because you get two strong-headed people. You know, you get a couple of cholerics going in different directions. I mean, you're going to have, you know, the fur is going to fly. But, and you know, I've seen that in places, in countries. But, yeah, the original team that goes in, they should know each other. They should understand more or less what their gifts are. Like one person is more apostolic in his way of doing things. Another person more, you know, gifted in teaching, pastoring. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about a team starting a work, going into a place that nothing has been before?
That's excellent. Yeah. in fact, that's about as ideal as you can get it. If you can go in where there is nothing and start something, that's really good.
What kind of suggestions do you have as far as getting in with your
network
and starting?
Ooh, yeah. Well, there's still room among the 4.7 billion people, you know. But I think that that's an important question. So often, what people do when they get involved in missions is they go with maybe, you know, the board that they grew up with or you know, they kind of pick a board because they had an aunt some time back there that was with that board. But you have to be careful who you go with, because you got to be sure that the board is of the same vision you are. Now, if the board happens to have the same vision that you have, then you'll feel like there are no restraints. I can do whatever I want to. And it's not that you can do whatever you want to, but you're doing what you want to, and it happens to be what the board wants to. And so everybody's happy. But I could tell you some real horror stories of people who have gone with boards that have boxed them in. Like just one, there's one guy that came down with this particular mission, and he had an idea about how everybody talks about church planting today. And I have some real questions about what we're talking about when we're talking about church planting. I mean, I have some real questions about it. The basic problem being the church planner has a blueprint in his mind. He knows what that church is going to look like before he starts. And that's the weakness in it. You don't know what it's supposed to look like before you start it, because a church will develop in response to the felt needs of the people that you're ministering to. And just because it works here, it doesn't mean it's even relevant there. But back to the horror story. This guy came in, and he came into the town that we were in, and we had some people. We didn't know what to do with the people we were reaching. And so I thought, well, boy, we've got some good people here. This guy's just getting started. He wants to start a church. And so I offered to give him a dozen young men. And I was just flabbergasted when he didn't, you know, there's no strings attached. You can have them. They're brand new Christians, see? And I just flabbergasted when he didn't even look at them. He wasn't even interested. Well, what he did was he took a year, 1 year. He just got out of language school, took 1 year, and he wrote 90 sermons. Then had a language helper translate those sermons into Portuguese. And then he got a tent. Now, can you imagine writing a sermon to people that you've never laid eyes on? That's one of the mistakes. And you don't know what the culture is all about yet, because you haven't even been there. And so you don't even know what's relevant and what isn't. But then he got a tent. And during a period of 3 months, he preached those 90 sermons, a sermon a night. Oh, I saw him downtown Curitiba about 2 weeks after this thing had gone by, and I said, well, how's it going? Oh, fantastic. He says, man, we had 120 converts. He says, well, we can plant a church every 90 days. We can plant a church. He says, we're going to go right down the highway, 383, down to Porto Alegre, and we're going to plant churches in all the major cities. Well, I didn't, you know, want to argue with him, but the first question came to my mind is, what are you going to do for leadership? And of course, you know, that was the Achilles heel in the whole thing. And he had to bring missionaries in to pastor the church he started. Well, what he didn't realize was that those 120 people, he had simply siphoned off from the evangelical community in the city. And there really weren't very many, if any, converts out of Catholicism. He was just kind of reorganizing the same body of Christ. See? Well, so after 8-9 months had gone by, the church was dwindling down from, and they started another one, had another 90-day blitz, and started another one, and they're starting a third. And so this first one, it dwindled down to 90, 70, 40, and then I met him downtown and asked him a few questions. Hey, we need to talk. And so they came over to the house, and we talked about, you know, just the philosophy of the ministry. Well, the three guys left, and one of them went around the block and came back and says, I got to talk to you in private. And he was pastoring this church. And so he says, what do I do? He says, I was sitting there in the church last week and had a sewing circle. And we used to have about 40 women come. And he says, this time there were six. And one of them says, yeah, you know that over in such and such a church, they have 40 women in their sewing circle. And this guy, Bob, he says, and I thought, yeah, next week they'll have 46. Because, see, when something starts to die, then people just migrate again. And so there's this migratory flock of people that are really kind of open to this kind of thing. See? Well, he says, what do I do? And I says, well, you've got to do more than preach at them. And so we talked about discipleship. We talked about getting into the homes. And we talked about you can reach people. See, if you reach people by, I'm jumping around here, but when you fish, the way you fish determines what you catch. So if you fish with a net, you're going to catch everything that the net encircles. If you fish with a hook, you're going to catch something else. And the kind of bait you use determines what you catch. Well, the problem with the ministry is that you've got to keep whatever you catch. And if you get 120 people that are basically migratory and have been sampling Christianity from going from here to there, you're stuck with them. And the probability that you will not have the makings of indigenous leadership there are very, very, very high. And so he was in a no-win situation. I said, well, Bob, you're going to have to begin to reach some people who have the potential. I asked him, do you have anybody in that congregation that even has the potential of becoming leadership? He said, no. I said, well, you've got to deal with that or you're dead. So we talked about how to do that. And so then he began to have some neighborhood Bible studies and began to be fruitful. Well, now, believe it or not, the head of this mission is a very well-known missiologist. And he came down and turned this guy's water off and told him that in this mission, the means of the ministry is preaching. Well, Bob just punted it. He went back home, gave up. See, what I'm saying is when you go with a mission, make sure you know what you're getting into, what the parameters are, what the vision, what the philosophy of ministry is, and make sure that it's in harmony with yours.
What about if you don't go with a mission? Because, like, I'm not sure what my desire is, but I think that I want to go over to New York and use my major as an inroad to relationships.
What's your major?
Agriculture.
That's good. We've got some guys around the world that are doing that.
Do you think the whole team needs to do that if that's what you decide to do with your team? Or?
Well, by the year 2000, 71% of the world will be beyond the reach of traditional missions. It'd be closed countries or semi-closed countries. And the only way you can get in is with a profession.
How do you recommend that a person like that, like I plan to be a university professor in a third world country?
That's excellent as well.
How do you recommend that you decide what kind of a church to associate with, or do you recommend sticking with Bible study type things or associating with a church that has non-university people in it or a ghetto type church? Or?
Well, let me give a piece of advice. The whole thing depends on what kind of cultural orientation you get when you first go in the country. And you will invariably see that culture through the eyes of your mentors, those who are teaching you the culture. Now, I think the safest thing to do is to establish rapport with the kind of people you eventually want to reach before you commit yourself to anything else. Establish rapport with the kind of people you eventually want to reach. And work at seeing the world through their eyes. And you will get a very different orientation to that culture than you would if you go to the evangelical church and see the world through their eyes. And then you'll be able to judge whether it's viable to operate out of a traditional framework and go to modern man. Or whether you'll have to start with modern man and work backwards. But you let your mentors be the non-Christians, the people that you want to reach, and try to discover from them how they view, what their values are, how they view Christianity, how they view the evangelical church, how they view Americans, etc., etc., etc.
You made a statement in your book. This man is created in God's image, therefore he has a natural receptivity to spiritual truth. All evangelism is predicated on this fact.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that somewhat? I don't get so really understand what you're
Well, what I'm saying there is that I have never talked to anybody in the world who, when I say when I talk about God, they give me a blank look and say, "God, what do you mean?" There are certain things that man is born with that he cannot escape. He might not believe in God, but he's conscious of the fact that he doesn't believe in God. See, and that is already, that's a common ground. I mean, you can put your foot on that and you can start from there. Now, what would you do if you run into a people who have no concept of God at all? Well, I wouldn't know where to start. But, like it says in Ecclesiastes, God has put eternity in their hearts. And then you have the factor of the conscience, like it says in Romans 2, where, their thoughts either accusing them or excusing them. And so the man has the law in his heart, and then he has a conscience telling him that he's not keeping it. And so he has the problem of guilt. And so you find that throughout the world, from one end to the other, this is a universal, is that man is struggling with his identity, his purpose in life, with the question of how do I deal with the paradox that's me, where I'm egoistic, but at the same time I deplore egotism. Those kind of things. That's the stuff that religions are made out of. And that's the stuff that philosophy is made out of. And every man is a philosopher. Every human being on earth is a philosopher. Because he has a worldview. He has a concept of what is there, and he has a concept of how he relates to that which is there. And so those are things that make man unique. And that's the starting point. Yeah?
Does that make them necessarily receptive?
No. But it makes them vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. I have a good friend who's a fairly strong Christian, but he believes he doesn't witness to anyone. He believes that witnessing or sharing your faith is like being an Amway salesman. It's like pushing yourself on somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to him?
Well, a lot of witnessing is that. And I used to. There was a time when I would witness just to show off. And I see people do that all the time. And you know how, you're around Christians and someone has witnessed that week how he managed to work that into the conversation somehow, Just like, led a couple guys to Christ last week. Oh yeah, and so the status goes up in some circles, see? And so maybe this friend of yours is taking his cues from that kind of behavior. But that doesn't let him off the hook, because we go back to the Bible, and it says those that turn many to righteousness will shine as the stars forever and ever. And I think that what he has to do is come back and he has to face the Bible on the issue. Yeah.
How do you pray for non-Christians?
Well, I believe that a non-Christian's will is inviolable. In other words, God cannot invade that person's will and force him. God will not override a person's will. But he can make it awfully uncomfortable for him. And there's this one guy who was Mario Nietzsche, who's now the country leader in Brazil, was witnessing to one of his buddies, a guy by the name of Assis. And they're getting ready for a party one night, and they're walking across this highway, went up to pick up some laundry, and this car came over the hill. Mario stopped. Assis ran across. The car hit him, went over him, thump, and then slammed on the brakes and dragged him about 150 feet. Well, we could hold his clothes in a little ball of blood like this, and broke his legs here, broke the pelvis, broke his collarbone, broke his arm, broke his bladder, his spleen, and just messed everything up. And he was in surgery for hours. Finally, it happened at 8, and finally at 3:30 in the morning, the doctor phoned me and told me, that surgery was over. And I said, well, what's the chances? He says, well, I've never had a guy come in like this and survive. So I got up, went down to the hospital, went into his room, and the oxygen tube had fallen out of his nose. There wasn't any nursing service, and he was laying there, heaving, his chest heaving, and I stuck the tube back in his nose, and the first thing he says is, I know what happened. He says, I know why I'm here. And he realized that God was using that, not that God caused the car to hit him, but God was using that to bring this guy to himself. Well, we mounted for 5 months, we had 24-hour nursing service for him among the Christians that come in and watch him, take care of him for 5 months while he was in the hospital. And then I'd go over to his house, and his legs were back, you know, down to, you know, like this after he got out, all atrophied his muscles. And so I'd study the Bible with him. But you know that even it took a year, even after that, to bring that guy to Christ. And he immediately linked his accident with the fact that he's resisting the gospel. And so what I'm saying is that God can make life awfully uncomfortable. I feel sorry for a person when I begin to pray for him. I go on John chapter 16, where it talks about the work of the Holy Spirit, and it says, when he comes, this is verse 8, he will convict the world of guilt in regard to sin and righteousness and judgment. In other words, the work of the Holy Spirit is to convict the person of guilt over his sin and of righteousness and of judgment. In other words, he realizes that he is guilty. He realizes that he doesn't measure up to God's righteousness, and therefore judgment is pending. That's the work of the Holy Spirit. Now, you pray this passage for a person and then be there to catch the pieces, because that person is really going to go through it. That's how I pray for a non-Christian.
Why do you think that it's hard, or why Christians are reluctant to initiate relationships with non-Christians?
Basically, it's because Christians are afraid of non-Christians, because they're afraid that I think the Christian's scruples keeps him away from the non-Christian. That's a major part. He's afraid that if he runs around with non-Christians, that they're going to have him doing things that he's not going to be able to do, and he'll get into an embarrassing situation where he'll say, well, I can't do that with you. And so I think that that's kind of an overriding factor.
Well, how do you get through that? How do you work through that?
Well, you're going to have to work through that on your own. But let me just say this. We need to take another look at our scruples. You know, the first legalist, you know who the first legalist was? Adam. Because remember in Genesis 3, Satan came up and tempted Eve, and what did she say? He says, well, Satan says, no, you know, what is this deal anyway? And she says, well, no, we can eat of any tree in the garden except that one, and neither shall we touch it. And that's where Satan had her. And where did she get the idea that she couldn't touch the tree? Probably from Adam. You know, we're guessing here. But he probably thought, now how am I going to keep this little thing out of trouble? And so he probably took her for a walk one day, took her over the tree, and said, see that tree over there? Don't touch it. And legalism is where you set a human fence around a divine law. And we do not dare go beyond what is written. And it's those things that go beyond what is written that keep us away from the non-Christian. Yeah?
What would be some indicators, because of the state of the United States, that we all need to be active evangelism in our neighborhoods, and that America does need the gospel just as bad as any other nation? What are indicators outside of just because of the fact you've been exposed to the needs of the world and a desire in your heart to be in missions, that show you that God really is trying to send you overseas rather than having you effective in the neighborhood, or maybe the corporation you're working at or whatever, and staying here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm not of the school that says get going and keep moving until God stops you. I just don't buy that.
Can you give reasons? Because a lot of us in the room have heard that.
Yeah. And I think that not everybody is wired together to handle a cross-cultural experience. Crossing a culture is no joke. It's no picnic. And I think you have to be a certain kind of person. And there are people all over the world who shouldn't really be there, I don't think, because of they spend 90% of their energy just coping with crossing the culture. And I think that to successfully go from one culture to another, you have to be a person who kind of enjoys ambiguity. I think a 2+2=4 type person really has a hard time when he goes to another culture, because he gets to the other place and he finds that they do things differently. And that at first is confusing. And so you begin to judge that other culture by saying, look at how they do that. Isn't that stupid? But what you're doing is you're using yourself as the criteria. And so I think that you have to be a person who enjoys ambiguity, who is secure enough to be able to open your hand to things that you might really consider to be, really precious. Be willing to have some inkling as to whether you're an adaptable, flexible person or not. I think another thing is, I think the basic requirement, the basic requisite, is humility. And we find this in Jesus in the Incarnation. We find this in the Apostle Paul, where he says, those things which are gained to me, I count loss. And he deliberately decided to strip away his eloquence, his ability to persuade. And he says, I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling, and my speech and preaching was not with enticing words, and so on. And so it's the humility that allows you to be vulnerable to people, and that allows you to not have to be front and center on the stage all the time, where you're willing to serve the other person. And, I think that's the essence of the ministry. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, another question.
And what you're saying is something that I think every Christian should be, humble and serving, and some of those things, yeah. Qualities. And so, can God give you a burden for certain people? I mean, like, how did you just have a burden for South Americans, just a natural love for those type of people? Or what was more like a course you got in that way?
No, in fact, I'm suspicious of people who have a fixation on a particular country. I've seen so much of that where people finally get there, and they just lay a square egg. I mean, there's no way, see, that... And you think, ooh, that was disastrous. I think you should assess yourself and say, now, is this something that I would really like to do? And you think, well, I might not like it, but I think it's something that I really ought to do. And, if you feel that it's something that you really ought to give serious thought to, then go begin to prepare yourself. And as you prepare yourself, I think you need to begin to ask God where you should go in the world. And I feel that God will lead you specifically. Gary Fries notwithstanding, I think that, God will lead you to specific places. And like in my situation, if it'll help you at all, was that, first of all, my wife and I decided that we were going to go overseas. And so that was our first decision. Well, once committed to that decision, we began to move in that direction. And we listened to a missionary from a particular group, went up and talked to him. He came out to the house. He talked to us about what they're doing. But it was this thing we were talking about a little while ago. I felt like I'd be boxed in by that particular group. And then there was another group where the director came and talked to us about going with them. And I just did not feel that their vision was compatible with what I had in my heart to do. And so I found myself in the Navigators. And I happen to be in the Navigators because I feel that there's room for me to exercise my vision. Not that it's the best group in the world or anything like that, but it happens to be in harmony with what God has laid on my heart. Okay, so I'm in the Navigators, but I still have to decide where and all of that. Well, in 1961, the Navs were thinking about various countries to open. Nigeria was one. Germany was another. The Philippines was another. Brazil was another. Well, every time I hear about one, I was all hot to go. And I was ready to go to all four of them, you know. The guy that jumped on the horse and rode off in all directions, you know. Then in the midst of that, a series of circumstances began to attract us to Brazil. The first one was I met a guy, a Brazilian businessman. I don't know his name. I never talked to him before or since, but I asked him some questions about Brazil. And I'd been reading the newspaper. Brazil was in a political crisis at the time. And I asked him, what is the basic need in the country? And he said, well, the basic need is leadership that has integrity. And I thought, well, we can do something about that. And then there was a passage of scripture that seemed to fit the situation in Brazil, Psalm 2. And I began to pray that for the country. Well, when you begin to pray for a country in that way, it's not long you're going to find yourself there, you see. And so I think that you make a series of decisions. The first one being, I'd like to go overseas. You begin to move in that direction, and you have other subsequent decisions. What group? Another decision is what country? And in the meantime, in the process, your vision has got to be growing. You want to be sure that you really know how you want to minister.
Okay, within that country, you know, you've got the country, you know where the country you're going to. What do you target initially to start your ministry? I mean, where do you usually target in it?
Well, there are several right beginning points. And so I would say, you know, there's an infinite number of options. And so you, for instance, what we've targeted on is university students, and I could make some arguments for that, but we targeted on the secularized university student. Well, you could also target on, let's say, the blue-collar workers, or you could go to the slums. Or you could target on young working people, because in these third world countries, maybe 1 in 1,000 youths will graduate from a university, and so you have this multitude of young working people. But I would say that whatever your target is, whether it's a slum, or whether it's a mega city, or whether it's a university campus, the one thing that you really want to try to do is make sure that that first generation you get is a keeper. Now, how you start is going to determine where you're going to be 10 years from now, because it all has its implications. And so, if you just kind of round up a room full of warm bodies, I mean, you're going to have that around your neck for the next 20 years. But if you start, I feel strongly about this, that when you start, you need to go to people that can share they can assume the mantle. They can share the responsibility to make this thing go, the leadership. And you'll probably have to, you know, do some pretty careful fishing there with, you know, you want there's certain kinds of people that you want to start out with then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, earlier tonight you said something about there were no churches a lot of times for the people that you would do the cross.
Yeah.
How would you deal with that? Would you start your own church, or would you try to...
Well, we would operate strictly on the basis of need. In other words, we lead these people to Christ, and I tried for several years. This is a story in itself, and I won't go into it, but I tried for several years. I had these people that were reaching out here in the world, and here was the church over here. And I had one foot in the church and one foot in the world. And it was kind of like having one foot in one canoe, another foot in another canoe, and prisoner you land in the water. In fact, tomorrow, a guy's coming to see me, a guy by the name of Jack Ahmet, who I spent about 10 years with, kind of one-on-one, in a discipling movement within the German Lutheran Church. And so I was working in that area, and they had their last national conference. They had 5,000 people on, by invitation only. It's just a movement that snowballed. But what I discovered was that the distance between the evangelical church and the people that we were ministering to was just unspannable, because there was rejection on both sides. And so what we would do is we would minister to the needs of those people. And as they grew and as they emerged, we would continue to minister to those needs. And so a university student has certain needs. He needs to get the biblical value system into his life. He needs to have some orientation. He needs to understand that you can't live the Christian life alone. It's got to be in community. Then he graduates, and he has a whole new set of needs. He has needs to, you know, for the first time, he's earning money. He has a job. He gets married. He has children. He gets into a community. And all those are brand new things that are hitting him. And so that we minister to those needs from the Bible. Well, then the children start to grow, and so there's a new set of needs. He becomes more adept at ministering to other people, and so that's another set of needs. And so what we do is we make disciples, and they become the church. See? Which is, by the way, the way it works out in the New Testament. Okay, several hands here. Let's see.
She had a question quite a
while. Okay, sorry.
You said this morning that you found that in Europe, 80% of the young people say that they don't care.
Yes.
And, I mean, if you meet people like this, that's kind of a helpless situation.
Yes.
What are you doing then? I mean, you know, if they say, well, that's something that becomes your solution for their life, and I found mine, so
yeah.
Just don't bother me any further. Is there still that you just try to make these people your friends?
Yes. I would say that Europe is one of the most difficult places in the world today for evangelism. And it's because of the secularization that it just, you know, moved in over the continent. But like we were saying just a little while ago, everybody cares about something. And you've got to start with that something. And you know that something is going to tie in to this over here eventually. And so you start with that something, no matter how fragile that is, how small it is, and you tie it in to what the Bible says about that. And it may take you a while to get them to get into the Bible with the person, but that's where you have to go. And eventually the question has to be dealt with, who is Jesus? Now, they are interested in things like relationships. And
yeah, but I mean the whole standard system is completely different today.
Yes. But see, what I'm saying is that if a person is concerned about relationships, friendships, I mean, you know, the European is the most lonely soul on earth, because he comes from a broken family that comes from a broken family that comes from a broken family. And for instance, in Sweden, They did a test of 11-year-olds, and they found that 10% of 11-year-olds in Sweden never had anyone ever say, I love you. Well, now, here's a person who is neither able to give or receive affection. And so, see, just emotionally and psychologically, he's really impaired. And so what do you do there? Well, he's vulnerable in the area of relationships. Okay, now what does the Bible say about relationships? And so we start there.
So you dig for the vulnerable.
We look for the vulnerable point, and we help the person in the area of his vulnerability. Not that we say, oh, you're vulnerable, look at there. See? But we help him be successful in the area of his vulnerability. And when he sees where our orientation comes from, he moves into the gospel. And we're having a lot of fruit in Sweden today by doing this and understanding this dynamic. Yeah. Okay, let's give this and then you.
What do you think of the concept of targeting a particular people or a race or a tribe or a culture?
Well, some parts of the world it works and some parts of the world it doesn't work. Society doesn't work that way many times. For example, you take Africa and you do an exegesis of Africa and you've got, how many languages and how many tribes? See, how many subgroups? And so you think, okay, now we have the makings of a strategy for Africa because we have all this stuff analyzed. But the fact is that you go to a city in Africa and they don't relate to one another that way. And if you try to treat them according to those subdivisions, they're offended because they want to be cosmopolitan. And so I would say that somebody has spent hours and hours at a computer, and someday it might be useful to us. But I think that, I think it attracts our attention to the fact that we have not reached the world. And in that sense, it's a very prophetic voice, this thing on nations and so on that we talk about. For instance, in the NAVS, we're working on a project on this right now. And we've identified 440 nations that we want to get into. Nation being an ethnos or a people that have certain commonalities. But what we found is that when we try to go tribal or try to go caste even in India, that it doesn't work. That people prefer to cross over. And so we have a saying in Portuguese that in theory the practice is something else again. See, just it never really quite works out the way the theoreticians make it.
In order to be obedient, we need to be seeing people come to know Christ, or in order to be obedient, we need to be involved weekly or daily. In order to be successful, we need to see converts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that I'm dealing with is I've been preached at for years in the idea that success is equated by numbers.
Yes.
How does a guy deal with that, or how does he get his mind on actually what is evangelism? How does he know what he's involved in is being obedient again?
That's a really good question. For 15 years in the NAVS, we kept track of how many converts and disciples and disciple makers we made in all of the world except Latin America. And I said, you'll have my job before you'll have my numbers, because I felt that it was a violation of the certain biblical principles. And I think we've gotten this from American management. We have, Americans are bottom line oriented. They don't want to, they don't want the, they don't want the printout. They just want to know the bottom line. Am I getting enough for my buck? And you have a lot of people who support the ministry who think that way. They want to know, how many converts. And I mean, the aberrations that this kind of thing produces will make your hair stand on end. Now, I'll resist the temptation to describe them, but we have this one guy, Bob Vidano, who has been working in the Middle East for 15 years, and more than that now, I guess. But in 1980 or 79, he went through a crisis because we went into the Middle East thinking we'll reach the Arab Christian, and he'll be a bridge into the Arab Muslim. Well, in some of these countries, like in Jordan, you got 99.5% of the population is Muslim. And so we reached this 0.5%. And we think this person is going to be a bridge into the Muslim world. One thing, we just overlooked one thing, and that is the 1,000 years of animosity that exists between the Christian and the Muslim. And it'd be easier for you to go in and love the Muslim than it is for a Jordanian Christian, Orthodox, to love the Muslim. He'd rather see him go to hell. And so it takes us years to get an Arab who has a Christian background to even consider the possibility of going to the Muslim. And, you know, but it, theoretically, once again, we have the theory. It's beautiful. The guy, you know, he speaks Arabic, and it takes a Caucasian, you know, 10 years to even be functional in Arabic. And so you think, man, what a shortcut. Let's just get some of these Orthodox Christians, so on. But, you know, we're making it. But to cut across to the point of my story, after 14 years of history, no, more than that, we started there in 1956, 58. So after 20-some years, 22 years of history, we had zero Muslims in the Middle East. And Vidano went through a crisis where he said, Vidano's the one that supervised the work in the Middle East. Before God, he says, I am superfluous. I'm irrelevant. But then he had to ask himself the question, am I willing to spend the rest of my life in the Middle East and see no fruit? And he came to the conclusion, yes, I'm willing to spend the rest of my life in the Middle East and see no fruit. He had to die. Now, we're beginning to see fruit. But, you know, it'll be over the bodies of this generation of missionaries that the Muslims of the future will cross over to Christ. This generation is not going to see the influx. So what is success? Success is being faithful to God right down to the end.
Well, maybe you can clarify something. Dawes, in Born to Reproduce, made a statement that if we're not seeing people to come to know Christ here, don't expect to do it anywhere else. And so I kind of get the feeling that he said, if you're not seeing any fruit, then you're not effective, you know, and yeah. You don't expect to do it anywhere else.
Well, I think, if I can differ with Doss, I'd say, and he's not alive to defend himself, but one thing is true, that if you are not giving yourself to people here, and if you are not ministering to people here, then don't go. So if you don't have a heart for people, and you don't have the capacity to open your life and let people into it, then you better not go. And so that you can spot here. There are some people who, are full steam ahead going to the mission field, but they don't give a damn about people, you know? And they get there, and that doesn't change. They live their lives, and it becomes a profession for them. See? And so I think, it's just something that you can test that. But I don't think you can do a whole lot about fruit. I think the only thing we can do is let's be sure that we're doing the right thing. Now, we want to see fruit, and Paul says, the more fruit, the more glory to God. And so he says, I want the gospel to abound among you. But, see, all we can ask of a person in a country, you know, like Jordan or something else, is that he be a student of the culture, that he be a student of the Bible, and he does what he can to draw those two together. And so, you know, as I go in and evaluate a ministry in a country, I'm not so concerned about how many have they had. In fact, I never even asked that question. What I want to know is, what are you doing? And, it's not working harder, it's working smarter. You know, are we going to the Bible? Are we getting your answers from the Bible? Are we just repeating old success patterns? See? Are we being creative in responding to people as they are? Or are we just persisting in what we've always done? See, those are the things that make the difference. Yeah?
Do you have any insights as to how the Muslims came and what we reached?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of things that can be done. By the way, compared the Muslim, I think, is the toughest case on earth, the Arab Muslim. Working in Eastern Europe, in the communist countries, is like teaching Sunday school compared to working with Muslims. I mean, the margin for error is just like that among the Muslim people. I mean, you make a mistake and you're dead. I mean, you know, we've lost some people who didn't make any mistakes. They just got killed. But one of the things, and this is just incredible, there are some simple things that can make an awful lot of difference. But the Christian missionary has gone in, and he has preached the gospel, and maybe once every 20 years, he'll have a convert. And usually that convert is kind of a marginal person in the society. And then he gets persecuted. He's kind of a hero in the local church there for a while. He gets persecuted, goes and lives with the missionary. Finally, the missionary arranges a passport for him, and he's back here in the U.S. And it's either that or loses life. See? Now, what we have failed to perceive is that Islam is not just a religion, it's a culture. And so, because we fail to perceive that, we virtually destroy our rapport with the Muslim. Because in Islam, the church, or less, the word church isn't there, but you know, the religion and the government are one and the same. And so the government will use the religion and adapt the religion to fit their political ends, and vice versa. The religion will adapt the political system to fit their ends. And out of that, you've got your institutions, like the military, the schools. Of course, you have your judiciary system, your legislative system, your economic system. All of it is both religion and state. And that works itself out in the arts, the music. It's both religious and political and cultural. It works itself out in the family, in the society. And so, if I lead a Muslim to Christ and come up to him and say, okay, now you are a Christian, you must leave Islam, I am asking him to do the impossible. I've lived in Brazil for 23 years. My kids were born there. They all went to Brazilian schools. They speak Portuguese a lot better than they speak English. And they're discovering that now as they're in school here. And even though we spent all those years, I cannot erase my Americanness. There's no way that I can cease being an American. And there's no way that a Muslim can cease being a Muslim culturally. And because we have confused this, and we say, okay, now you're a Christian, you must give up Islam, we are virtually shooting ourselves in the foot. And we've done this ever since modern missions has begun, which, you know, is to me quite incomprehensible, you know, that we could be, you know, that naive about it. And for the Muslim, if he discovers that his neighbor has become a Christian, it'd be like you discovering that your neighbor is a communist spy passing billions of dollars of military secrets over to the enemy. And if you go over and shoot that neighbor, you'll be considered a hero in your society. And that's exactly the way it is in Islam. And so what we have to do, we have to come to grips with the fact that every culture, and the Bible says this, that culture was God's idea. And he fixed the time and the places for nations in the world. And so every culture, there's got to be a way. And if there are barriers, first of all, we have to ask, are the barriers right here? And usually there are enormous barriers right here. We remove the barriers here, we find that people are accessible. And so is it not possible for a person to be a follower of Jesus and to live according to this book and be a Muslim culturally? Well, it's got to be possible, because they are a part of the human race, and the Great Commission applies to the whole human race. So it's not negotiable. And so, yeah, I mean, I could go on and on, but there are a lot of things that we can do to close the distance between the gospel and the Muslim. And we're working on that. Yeah.
It seems to me that there's certain things that would be absolute that you can't compromise.
Right.
Cross-culturally. Is the family, you said this morning that your family was your ministry team.
Mm-hmm.
Is the family one of those things that is principally...
No. The family... we happen to enjoy in America a certain family structure. We have up to now a certain family structure that's you know pretty dynamic. But you know the family has not been, you know, historically in most cultures you do not find the equivalent. For instance, in Africa, just a few months ago, I was sitting talking to a guy, and he said that his grandfather didn't even know the names of his kids because he had so many wives. And so one of his kids would come with his report card, and the first question his grandfather would ask is, "Who's your mother? Go talk to her." Because he didn't know the names of his own kids. Well, okay, let's say that a man like that comes to Christ. What's he going to do? Is he going to pack off 90% of his children and his wives and devote himself to one? Those are hard questions, but they're the kind of questions that missionaries are faced with all the time. You know, the Bible teaches a husband to love his wife, to raise his children in certain patterns and so on. But to try to model the family after the American model is also to make a mistake in a new culture. Yeah. It gets sticky, doesn't it? Yeah.
We really value the family in America.
Yes.
We all want to have a family.
Yes.
So, just out of your own personal experience, see, all your kids are born there. Now, if, you know, what we have kids, or we did, you know, I mean, is that an awkward position? Because, see, it's just not something with you once you become a family. It's something because of your wife and your kids, and not taking them to another culture and another value system, and the whole, you know, the whole
yes.
charge, you know. So if a person is really set on missions, I mean, would you suggest to put that on hold to an appropriateness, or I mean, how's that dealt with? Because that, I mean, when you're single, you know, all you got to deal with yourself. But once you get married, then you're considering other individuals.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think you do need to take it into consideration. I get people all the time who want to go overseas, and they talk to me about it. Like, there's a guy just last week. Well, he wants to go to Africa, and he has children that are 8 or 9 years old. Well, he wants to go to French-speaking Africa. Well, for him to learn French and to get in and do something of any significance will take him 10 years. Well, at that point, he will have to go home. Because in Africa, you can't do like we did in Brazil, where we just mixed and integrated, because the social and cultural distance is so great. You know, we're not talking about the racial distance, but the social and cultural distance is so great that it's just very, very difficult for for intermarriage to occur, you know, with a Westerner and an African, given the diversity of the cultural backgrounds. And so here you have kids who are going to have to reintegrate back into the Western world. And there comes a point where you've got to do that. And so you're going to have to pick up and pull out. And so I think where you go in the world is going to influence your family considerations. And I think the ideal time for a couple is they should have enough time before they go to another culture to have worked through their own cross-cultural and have that worked out. And then, our oldest daughter was 2.5 when we moved to Brazil, and she didn't even know we moved. See, she enjoyed the boat ride, but she didn't know we moved. And she learned English and Portuguese together. and there's no trauma. But you get kids that are up there a little bit further, and man, they go through it, you know. And so there is a time, yeah.
So would you think it'd be incorrect thinking to say that I cannot really consider an individual unless maybe she had missions on her heart too?
Well, if you are serious about going to another culture, you had better find a partner that's equally serious.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to take one more question.
Okay, yeah. All right. Yours is the question.
In your talk, you spoke of reaching medical people.
Mm-hmm.
And also speaking of reaching university people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking one day of perhaps going and teaching at a foreign university, and mm-hmm. others too are. In your experience, do you find that is strategic to reach a certain strata of society, and does it filter down to, you know, from the university educated elite, one out of a thousand, to the rest, or to mm-hmm. stay stratified?
Boy, you guys ask really good questions, and I like this question too. And I collected a stray thought that I was going to make in answering your questions about nations. I think that's just the way society works, that you go to people that have affinity. And so what I found is that if you have people, you try to put people together that can't make small talk together. They're uncomfortable with each other. And so if you get a doctor and you know, some other profession, a lawyer together, pretty soon they run out of things to say to each other. And what that does, it tends to formalize the environment. See, and so you don't have the spontaneity. And so I would say, you know, in answer to the thing on nations too, you go with the flow. You follow the affinity lines. And you find in the New Testament, as a matter of fact, that most of the people mentioned are some short-tailed relationship with Jesus. You know, I mean, just it's a very small circle of people that were close to him. A lot of them were relatives of his. And there were just very few original sources of kind of trees of relationships, webs of relationships. And you work those, and you'll find that you'll have more business than you can handle as far as just interest in things. And you violate that. We've had some very interesting experiences along that line. For instance, I don't know how you'll take this, but in Mexico, we had, you know, the idealism. We had this very wealthy group of people, and we had this group from Avenida Ocho, which is a street in Mexico City, in the poorer section of town. And so we would bring these people together. And what we found, what we discovered, was that when the Avenida Ocho people were together with the wealthy, that they were quiet, inhibited, they did not bring their friends, and the wealthy people kind of dominated things, but they didn't bring their friends either. And we were in a cul-de-sac. We split them according to their social status, which really sounds like a no-no, you know, but we did that, and both groups flourished. See? Now, what is it we're after? Well, we want the gospel to flourish. See? And so that's part of the question. The other part of the answer. The other part is, yes, it does filter down. And you'll find that there will be people who are one generation removed from poverty, or they have relatives who are there. Or, like, we have a ministry among fishermen in this one town in Brazil, and it all started through the mother of one of the guy's wives. And so there are about 100 fishermen that have come to Christ, and just as a result, kind of offshoot. And then we have a ministry in the slums, because the son of one of the people that we reached had a burden to go to the slums, so he went, and he has a little team of people, and they're working in a slum. And so, yes, it will work out, but you can't just leave it to the automatic process. I think you need to strategize to go into the other strata as well.
So are you saying the affinity lines, your affinity lines, like, how you can relate, or are you talking about reaching people where they're at as far as helping them reach where their people they can relate to?
Okay, that's perceptive. And I think I would say when you go to a new culture, you got enough working against you to not make it harder for yourself than you need to make it. And so I tend to evangelize people that I enjoy being around anyway. And then they reach people that they enjoy being around. And I don't know how spiritual this is, but that's just kind of the way it works, you know. And you find you have a lot in common, and you really get some chemistry going, see. And so I don't think there's anything wrong in evangelizing people that you naturally gravitate to. It's kind of going uphill to try to evangelize people that you don't respond to at all. Now, Jonah did that and wasn't very happy about it. And sometimes God will send you to do that. But yeah, I think that's an affinity helps. But I think another thing we need to realize is that the world is not a nice place. And we're ministering to people who, in a lot of ways, their lives are very ugly because sin has messed them up so much. And so they do things that destroy their families, that destroy themselves. And see, you see that happen, and you think, ugh, that's terrible. And so I think that I don't want to leave the impression that you just minister to people that you like or that you like to go to. Many times you minister to people that are offensive, to you and to society and everything else, because the gospel is for them.